That was a track called Keepers of the Flame that Kirk and I made. And we have donated now to the Songs for Standing Rock to help support the water protectors that are protesting the North Dakota pipeline. DAPL, if you will. And it'll be available at songsforstandingrock.com. Albums are available on a pay-what-you-want basis with 100% of the sales going directly to the creation of permanent, sustainable winterized geodesic domes, wood stoves, and firewood supplies at Standing Rock so that we can sustain that protest throughout the winter and as long as we need to. Thank you if you go donate. All right, let's get started with our Thanksgiving 2016 episode. All right, welcome to episode 38 of Chasing Sound. I'm Andrew.
This is Kirk right here, y'all. Happy Thanksgiving, which just happened. When we upload this, it'll be a few days past Thanksgiving, so I hope everyone is still alive and doing well.
Hope there wasn't some sort of crazy turkey revolt in which we all lost our heads.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, somebody overdosed.
Too much tryptophan. They slept forever.
So we're doing this episode naked, which is new.
Yeah.
And Andrew is not putting a towel on his chair.
No, it's my chair, so I can put my everything on it.
He maintains that his taint is so large and hairy that it technically is a towel. So we're trying that out. Trying to just get more comfortable in our own skin.
Yeah.
We figured we'd do it on an episode without a guest. So this is episode 38. We're going to talk about recording stuff and a few other things, whatever. Maybe 80s hair metal.
What'd you think of that first little jam there?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Kirk, so, speaking of recording stuff.
This episode opens with a musical number. I accidentally deleted it off my looper, so that's the one and only
true
version of that. But it's basically, I came up with it last night running my new little tiny analog drum machine, which is the Korg VocaBeats. A little, just like, as big as maybe a big pedal, you know?
Yeah.
Not much bigger. And I ran it into my amp through the effects. I looped a drum part. The cool thing about the drum part is I was twisting the gain knob on the hi-hat, so it has this like little whistly industrial sound going. And then I put a loop on top of that, which is just a drone of D. And then I came up with a bass line that I played on guitar. It's just a very bassy guitar line with no wet effects on it. It just is the compression, basically a clean tone with compression stretching it out to give it a very airy sound. And then Andrew,
I've been practicing my flute, as you can tell.
Andrew played violin that sounded a shitload like a flute. We took out a lot of the high end and the low end, and left the mids up at about 12 o'clock on all of his, your preamp thing as well as your amp EQ, and then the...
So you just get a very, like, basic, direct, fundamental tone with not a lot of overtones.
Strips away a lot of the overtones, and then for the tone that we got for you, I think we owe a lot to that cheap Chinese OCD clone, the Joyo Ultimate Drive, which is a, you know...
Why didn't they call it the Ultimate Joyo Drive?
I don't know. It's got a devil painted on the front, which I always hated, so I put a sticker over it that our friend Tatiana made that says, "Save the humans."
Woo! Save the humans.
That's a way to save a shitty pedal, like, or if it has shitty artwork, just put a sticker on it.
That's right. Stickers... are the ultimate in covering up shitty art. Like in bathrooms and, you know, advertisements.
Your trapper keeper.
That's right. Yeah, people should put more stickers over bad advertising. It's just, you know.
There should just be more stickers.
Yeah, totally.
So you've been...
Everything should look like the Mohawk's bathroom.
Or like, for those of you who don't live in Austin, the punk rock club's bathroom.
Yeah.
Where there's no mirror left. It's just stickers of forgotten punk and hardcore bands.
Yeah.
So you've been cobbling together some tunes for a solo album. Yeah?
That's right. I've been working on it as much as I'd hoped because other recording gigs have been coming in.
Yeah.
Which is good. And I've been
doing
some
stuff.
Yeah,
we had a gig
stuff.
Together on Sunday.
But, oh
last,
yeah, that's
last
right.
Last Sunday, yeah, I was there 8 hours. Man, that was a long run for me.
Yeah, we're working on Skylar and Ryan's new joint.
Our friends,
first
yeah,
joint.
Their first joint. Our friends, who are basically like a two-man band. But they're bringing in a lot of friends to play the instrumentation.
Yeah.
Our friend Ryan, he did the drums, a lot of guitar and vocal on his songs. And then Skylar did even more guitar and vocals on his numbers. And then their friend JP played the bass, and he's this teenage Mexican prodigy kid.
Yep.
He's just a shredder on the bass. And so I went in to do some rhythm guitar parts and a couple of solos.
Yeah.
And one kind of like a Nashville running up and down the fretboard solo, and another one that was more like a Neil Young style thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Andrew, what did you do? You did some mandolin.
I did, yeah, mandolin and violin. But I did a lot of mandolin. They wanted
a lot of mandolin.
And so that was cool. I mean, it was pretty, just kind of. Being part of the rhythm section mostly. I did
a
couple
of name
of like
that studio. I want to give it a shout out, but I can't remember.
Time something or other.
Maybe, you know what? We'll put a link in the description of this episode.
Yeah.
To give that guy a shout out. That guy's got a badass home studio.
Yes.
He basically built a studio onto where his house would have ended.
Yeah, it was like the former patio. He kind of like covered up the old outside patio.
Yeah.
And put his control room in there, and he had a...
He's got two isolation rooms.
Uh-huh.
He's got a rack of preamps and shit that, like...
To die for.
One of the biggest I've ever seen. Like, that, as big as the one at the Switched On Synth store.
Oh, yeah. It's as big as I've seen in, I recorded at The Orb and the Recording School of Austin, so it's...
You ever been to The Bubble?
Never been to. Well, I live in Austin. I'm in the bubble all the time.
Yeah, there's the bubble.
Thank you, SNL.
The Bubble Studio is one of the more famous Austin places. It's run by Frenchie, a guy that used to be.
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. I've recorded there.
I thought so. I thought you had.
Yeah, I've recorded at Frenchie's place. I just can't remember. It's called the Bubble.
There's a few other good. So Jim Eno, the drummer from Spoon, has a badass studio.
Yeah. This town is lousy with good studios.
Good studios, and it didn't always used to be that way. It's really come up. A lot of the artists that were playing bars in the late 90s are now in the production end of things.
Yeah. They got smart and decided they didn't want to hang out in bars.
Yeah, like Jim Eno said, I heard him in an interview saying, like, always be generating revenue. In this day and age, we can't lean on record sales. You need to figure out a way to generate revenue.
Yeah.
So, like, when he's on tour with Spoon, there are other guys at his studio making records.
Right.
So even while he's away, he's turning a profit.
Yeah.
Good words to live by if you want to live off of
sure.
Music.
And, of course, our friend Matt at Ice Cream Factory.
Ice Cream Factory, yeah. Dude, I totally forgot about that. Yeah, that's a fantastic space.
So, it's an... Apparently, Willie has a really nice studio somewhere near here. Pernalis, I think is what it's called. Yeah, so it's happening. It's
yeah,
a happening town. That was probably one of the ones that's been around for ever.
There's one on South Lamar that's been around forever. Yeah. When I worked at the 7-Eleven on South Lamar in Austin, when I was like 19 and 20, famous ass people would come in.
Right,
famous to me, like Gibby Haynes from the Butthole Surfers came and got like gas in his hot rod car while he was recording there. So while Spoon was recording Series of Sneaks, their second album, they recorded it there, and they came in and bought some beer. And I was just starstruck, man. Like, buddy guy came in one time. It's just like, to me, these people were huge.
Yeah.
And so that's like supposedly a really nice one. Somewhere off South Lamar. I've never been to it. But Ice Cream is probably the nicest as far as what he's got. He's got the roll-away piano, the upright piano on wheels.
Yep.
He's got a really nice drum riser.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just got cool shit.
Well, this last place had a nice piano too. So I was
yeah, in his living room. That's right. He did drums and piano in his living room, yeah. Which got a great like Led Zeppelin IV kind of sound.
Yeah,
nice and big and open.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hallmarks of the Austin scene is the home recording geniuses we have making something out of practically nothing. You know, and
so there's always bands that need to put together or songwriters that need to put together a record or people maybe stopping off on tour need to record real quick.
I'm gonna look up that place now because I'm like,
yeah, you want to get the name of it?
We sound like idiots.
Well, that's a given. That is something that we did know going into this. We would sound like
we
idiots.
Are idiots, so what else are we gonna sound like?
So let's talk see. A bit about what you're putting, like how many joints you got together so far for your solo effort.
Well, I'm going to record, probably like 10 tunes that we've been doing, or I've been doing on my solo violin pieces. And then I feel
so
like
you
I've got.
You have 10 that you.
Oh, yeah, sure. I definitely have 10 different tracks that I can draw from and clean up and
are you gonna put like any of the covers like the Herbie Hancock or the Frank Zappa?
I don't know about that. I haven't thought about doing that or not. Because then I gotta
into the cost.
Throw in more money. I'm trying to do this kind of cheap.
Do it original.
So so we're gonna, you know, so but you know, I'll look into that and see what I need to do. But yeah, I mean, those are definitely things that I'll perform live, but I don't know if I'll necessarily record them. I'd rather it be me. Oh, hello. Mm-hmm. And so doing that, but mostly I wanted it to be my kind of like solo fiddle and mandolin stuff. And I've got some new stuff. I'm always working on new things. In fact, that'll be the last thing on the podcast today. I'm going to play a new piece that I wrote that was inspired by our second to last guest, Indradeep Ghosh, and hanging out with him. And I that's another, because I've been taking lessons with him, and I just, it was a part from one of the rogs that he plays, and it just inspired me to kind of learned that rog, and then
how did you meet that guy?
So I met him through the Tosh guys. Roberto wasn't there. It was actually Charles, who was our cellist on the podcast too. It's a, you know, you're just listening to our community out there if you're enjoying this. Yeah. We're all hanging out together too, and that Charles was going over to the jam at Indrajit's house. Indrajit plays sitar. He's, you know, a classically trained Indian sitar player. And then he was playing with these three guys, Gauri Shankar, Indradeep Ghosh. Can't remember the other guy's name right now, but Santor player. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met him. And I've just been looking for somebody because I've been listening to that style and wanting to learn that style for a long time. But anyway, so I took another lesson with him on Friday.
How did that go?
Very well. Very nice. Like it's lovely. We worked on some of the some more another rag and some more fundamentals of playing the slides mostly. They're called Mir. Is what the
slides you were playing me earlier?
Yeah. So sliding through the tot or the scale, and so I've been practicing on that, and I'm gonna work on that. He's gonna be gone. I'm not gonna get another lesson till February, so I got plenty of time to work on these couple of things, and I also dug out a book, you know, like. You know, here's the thing for you musicians out there. You know, you want to learn something new, and you don't have a direct connection to that musical culture, except for maybe YouTube is the closest thing you can get.
Yeah.
But you can go out and get books, which is, you know, used to be like the only way to do it. And so I got a book on Indian music, Indian classical playing that I tried to get into a couple of years ago, but you know, it's really hard to do it just all by yourself with a book. So it didn't get very far, and I got frustrated and just kind of gave up, you know. And so I just kept listening and kept trying to get better at my instrument anyway, because, you know, really it's once you get to a certain level of mastery on your instrument, other doors are easier to open than if when you're not quite there yet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that was, and I felt like, so that was a couple of years ago, and here I am, like, say 5 years later, and finally find, like, a guy who's a master in the style to go hang out with and learn from, and then I'm also more of a master myself, so I'm ready to do that sort of stuff. So, so yeah, we had a good lesson. I brought over some, oh, speaking of other people in our community, our podcast community, Michelle Alani was through town. She lives a gypsy lifestyle, and I don't mean to make that comparison with her music, but she's always on the move.
Any gypsy listeners.
And and I don't mean to offend any gypsies. Roma. We know. You're Roma. It's cool. Maybe you should get a country one day. Maybe we should help you with that. She was through, and she came over and hung out and brought me a big old packet of klezmer music.
Like, what is that?
Klezmer is the, let's call it, I mean, it's Jewish music is what it is. But more specifically, it's the Jewish music of Eastern Europe, I'm pretty sure. Okay. So speaking of gypsies.
I was picturing Russian kick dancing Jew style stuff.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Although I'm not sure if that's actually, well, that's, yeah, like in Fiddler on the Roof kind of sort. Yeah, that may be true. I don't know a whole lot about this stuff. So I don't want to make any, I don't want to say anything.
So what did she just bring you?
But she just brought me a packet of, yeah, it's like 25 klezmer tunes. It's called like Klezmer for Everyone, which I like, and they're well edited and easy to read, and we were playing through those, and I noticed, hey, the scale in here is similar to one of the Indian scales. So when I went over to see Indradeep, I was like, hey, here's this piece that I've been playing, check it out, it's got the same scale in it, sort of. And so I scanned in the packet of papers into my computer.
Yeah.
So I'll just pass on. So if anybody wants to email me, I've got a ton of klezmer music that you can start.
Are there any renowned artists who focus on that?
Oh, sure.
Style?
Well, for example, John Zorn.
Oh, I love Zorn.
He's kind of like an avant-garde composer, but he draws from that style a lot. I couldn't really, well, you know, another person who is really into playing klezmer music that I've known is my friend Mark Rubin, who was in the Bad Livers, and I used to work with at the violin shop.
Was he the mando player in the Bad Livers?
No, he's a bass player.
Bass player, yeah, big guy. I remember
him. Big guy. And he's Jewish and tapped into his musical heritage and plays that music. In fact, the last time when I was working at the shop, which was many years ago now, he would leave for the weekend, go up to New York and play a couple of Jewish weddings and make big bucks.
Yeah.
And it was enough to pay for his flight up there and back and then still have money afterwards. And so he got deep into that scene and, he already was, you know, he's all about folk music. That's why he's, you know, the Bad Livers was a bluegrass band.
Bad Livers, I actually heard of them before I moved to Austin. That was how much people liked them. You know, they made it into some music magazines and stuff. And then when I got to Austin, like the mid-90s, they were the Bad Livers and the Asylum Street Spankers were the roots, like bluegrass style and country and ragtime and stuff. You know, Spankers covered the whole range.
I think that was a outgrowth of the whole like alternative music kind of movement was that people started to get back into traditional music in a better way. But I always love the Spankers and the Bad Livers because they had this kind of like ironic kind of punk rock mm-hmm. kind of thing going on. Like, you know, like they weren't going to go back to the non-ironic kind of like messages of mm-hmm. the original traditional music, you know, or they were going to play up even more the euphemistic over mm-hmm. undertones of or overtones or whatever of the you know, the style, you know.
They would definitely focus, lyrically focus on the dark side
yeah.
of country that, and rockabilly culture.
That record by the Spankers, The War on Drugs, mm-hmm. oh my God, you gotta listen to it. It's one of my favorite records. That's my wife, who, you know, we're both Kentuckians, and we were growing up in Kentucky. That was like, you know, her connection to Austin mm-hmm. was... the Asylum Street Spankers. She was a huge Spankers fan, and we went and saw them at least once in Kentucky. She probably went a couple of times, and you know, when we were moving to Austin, that's what she was most excited about yeah. going to Austin for, was, you mean the Spankers are there mm-hmm. and we can go see them? I'm like, uh-huh. And so we would go see the Spankers, you know, a lot when we first moved down here.
Yeah, I would go constantly. When I first moved to Austin, the Spankers played Wednesday and Sunday at the Electric Lounge, and they would do two sets per yep. night. And I would make at least one of set per week of the Spankers. Like, if I had to roll nickels to pay my cover to get yeah. in, it was only $6. The last sure. time I saw them, I paid like $20 to get in.
Yeah.
But yeah, they did no electricity, and it was basically the all-star band of yeah. Austin. All the shredders. Acoustic
like,
shredders.
Wasn't like
we had Olivier from 8 1/2 Souvenirs. Yeah. He would play the saw and the jazz, gypsy jazz guitar. You had Guy Forsythe playing the resonator yeah. and doing killer lead vocals.
Yeah,
Christina Mars doing her amazing vocal and ukulele and banjo uke. You had Pops Bailiff.
Yeah,
played banjo and banjo uke. You had the Colonel, acoustic guitar player, Mysterious John. They're just like, yeah. you know, and then they had all these other players. Whammo, of course.
Whammo, of course, yes.
And they've been through a few different drummers and bass players, all of them excellent.
Yeah. They're not the most important part of this Spankers.
No, but they ham it up, too. Like, the drums and bass, will, like, upright bass and cocktail drum, and they'll usually take a solo, or the drummer will play on the bass player's yeah. strings, and
yeah.
they ham it up. Like, that is the name of the game for the Spankers.
Yeah, so, anyways, but that's a particular kind of traditional music, and actually one that I've never been super excited about, because I've always been kind of like, you know, I like to listen to it, but mm-hmm. playing it, I'm just kind of like, alright.
I don't know.
Okay.
You really have to haul ass playing that stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's great, but it's just not my... I mean, I like the Django jazz, and that's about it. But, you know, like... And I don't do that all the time. But anyways, so I was just... Yeah, we got there because of the Jewish music and the... Mm-hmm. You know, the klezmer music, you know, again, is the music of the... I think of the Eastern European Jews, although... Maybe klezmer may just imply like Jewish music, traditionally Jewish music anyway. But the interesting thing, and that I was talking about with Indradeep, is as far as I know, is uh-huh. that the... So if you think of like Eastern Europe in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, 20th century, up to the 20th century, you have a Christian majority... And they're the people who are actually running the government, making mm-hmm. all the rules and blah, blah, blah. You know, whether they're Russian or whatnot or Polish or however, you know, whatever the thing is. Although sometimes it could have been Turkish, because I think some parts of Eastern Europe, like the Balkans, were mm-hmm. controlled by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire in that period. Yeah. But the gypsies... And the Jews, maybe the Jews to a bigger extent, were minority populations, right? And they were like an oppressed minority population.
Definitely.
Although they had some autonomy, so usually I think the way it worked back then was sometimes they were slaves, like straight up slaves. Mm-hmm. You can look into that like the gypsies and the Jews were like, you know, basically slaves in some parts. So they were like, you know, working the land and subsisting, but not getting anything from it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when they weren't exactly slaves, they were always still the underclass. You know, they were second-class citizens or whatever. But the nice thing is, so we're musicians, and it's kind of cool to be a musician in the 21st century. But for most of the time in the history of the world, musicians are the lowest of the low.
Yeah, it's just true.
You know, unless you're talking about classical musicians, maybe in Western Europe or, you know, priests or whatnot. But for the most part, like your typical, the musician that you're going to find entertaining the common people is not going to be held high in most societies. So that's true in Eastern Europe at the time. And so those jobs are, or the, when music is needed, it's provided by the underclass of people because the upper class doesn't bother with it, or they're bothering with a different type of music, a spiritual music,
patriotic.
Yeah, maybe not even that though then, because it's still kind of like, you know, that's kind of a different idea. But anyway, it's so what's interesting about Eastern European music to me very much so is the mixing between the Gypsy and the Jewish culture, and that there was a lot of crossover. So like, and they're both Asian, like either Middle Eastern or actually Indian, because the Gypsies are, as best we know, Indian group of people that moved west, you know. And of course, the Jews are originally from Palestine, and then they move north and east to wind up in Eastern Europe or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they bring with them those influences of the Middle Eastern and Indian music.
The Gypsies, or like the original Gypsies, are hailed from India.
That's the going theory. Is that and I believe that. You know, they've done the DNA testing and stuff like that to see if that's true. And they, so they're, they're a group of people who moved up and out of the Indian subcontinent.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know exactly why or wherefore, you know, they did that. But then they wind up in Europe, and so they...
So where did the Gypsy jazz style of...
Well, like, Gypsy jazz is just Django Reinhardt,
I mean,
you know.
I can trace it back to Django, no problem, and then, like, he played with some badass people before World War II.
Well, the main thing is, again, like I was saying, that the underclass gets the job of being the musicians, right?
Of course, yeah.
So they're the ones who get also really good at being musicians, you know, because, like, you know, and they create their own particular styles.
What else are you
going to
do?
Well, that's the other thing, too, is, like, you got to remember that at that time, like, you know, where would you encounter music in your world if you were, like, living in that world?
I think about that shit all
Not
the time.
Not a lot,
like,
right?
Where would you find strings? Where would you instrument repair?
I mean, so think of all the things that we take for granted about music, that it's ubiquitous, you can hear it on the radio anywhere, or that... you have free time to practice music, or that you can just go to a store and say, here's $500 bills, give me a decent instrument that works.
Exactly.
You know,
when
all
you
of that is
food. How could you, you know, how could you do that? But
so,
even like finding guitar strings, I've heard George Harrison talk about
when
they played in Germany, if you broke a guitar string, you just made do. They would continue to play sets minus one string.
Sure.
Or they would, when the club owner wasn't looking, they would steal one of the higher strings off the piano.
Yeah.
Or you hear of Chet Atkins saying when he was learning ukulele, he would, when a string would break, he would yank a piece of the screen door, like just a wire, and tune it up. And
yeah, just whatever you got
just
laying around.
They had nothing else to work with.
Because, you know, a lot of, like... So, you know, a lot of the sacredness of music and musical instruments comes from scarcity, right? So that, you know, you just can't, you know, like, or can be interpreted that way. I mean, so anyway, and then to me, again, it was just back to that moment of sharing that music with Indradeep and Michelle. It's this idea of just cross-cultural connection, and that the, you know, just like if music is a language, think of it that way, that, like, there's little dialects of that language all over the world. It's all, you know, has basically the same functions of communication and entertainment and storytelling or whatever.
But they feel very different. Michelle was talking about that, some of the music she encountered in Europe. She had never
Making people dance, you know, like having a function, you know, whether it's to...
It has a job. Entertainment mm-hmm. is a job, yeah.
Yeah, you know, by entertainment, I don't necessarily just mean, like, bass entertainment. You know, it could also
doesn't have to be a dance. It could be a concert or a ballet. But, yeah, there is a certain function, a basic job to it, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, it was cool because it was like, oh, look, here's little bits of that Indian scale in this stuff.
But like the way all of our languages, like the words are kind mm-hmm. of similar enough. Like the word hello is, you know, hola, or it's right. like they all have these connective tissue.
Well, and the other thing too is it's sort of music is sort of, well, I don't know. It's funny to think about that music is standardized now. So it's a closed system now. It wasn't always like that, but mm-hmm. so maybe sometimes, because this, by the way, this music was notated, you know, it's like I said, it's a book of note, you know, it's using standard Western notation. And so because it's standardized, things look maybe more similar than they actually are. So, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, who knows what that, it was a horror, who knows what the original horror really sounded like.
Yeah, I was.
But then they notated it a certain way, and in that certain notation, uh-huh. it looks like the scale that is from India, if that scale was notated in the same way. You know what I mean? Yeah. Now they're not exactly the same, but they're pretty darn similar. You know?
No, yeah. I definitely got what you mean. Yeah. Whenever Genuine Cello was on, I was asking her about that. Tunings, or I think we were just discussing tunings around that time, like what was the first standard tuning of any strung instrument,
right?
You know,
who knows, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And like I guess I did some online research after that podcast and found that there's kind of a hole in history, like there's mm-hmm. a lot of stuff that happened musically in the development of music that never got captured,
sure,
and recorded, much like all of history,
yeah,
where bridging it together and we're like having faith that some of the texts are correct, yeah. You know, working with what we got, but really there's a blind spot, yeah. And now everything is, you know, very standardized,
right,
there's, you know, there's certain situations where a more accurate version of standard tuning might be used. I've heard people discuss of different digit counts for different, like, oh, we're gonna I don't even know how they break it down at different standard tuning intervals, like,
yeah,
it's usually done by number, I think.
Well, sure, there's all, oh, like you mean like the
we're gonna tune to 440 standard,
oh, but... So that's, yeah, well, you can, so that just means you're gonna pick a, like, this pitch is going to be this frequency, uh-huh. and we're gonna tune the rest of it, because tuning is always done by ratios, mm-hmm. right, it's just mathematical ratios, so. But which is, so you can only do it once you pick a point to start from, right? It's like uh-huh. building a house. You pick where the corner of the house is going to be and you go from
the
there.
Foundation, yeah.
Right? And same thing with building a tuning system, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
wait, I want to cover a little bit more about your solo album. So
okay.
You're going to record it here in your home studio, right?
I'm going to try to do most of it here, and if it sounds terrible, I'll go somewhere else.
Let's talk about some of the gear you're going to use for that.
Yeah. Well, right now I've just got good mics.
Mm-hmm.
Not great mics, but mics.
Good. Yeah.
I didn't bust the bank, but I got good mics. And I've been very frugal about collecting them over time.
You're a good deal shopper too.
Yeah, because I've been in no rush. It's not like I'm gonna open up a studio tomorrow or anything like that, or when I was buying these I wasn't intending to like do something then, you know, immediately.
No, but you were careful. I remember when you bought the first really nice one, you later saw that Guitar Center had a used even better one.
Yeah.
And you like took back the new one.
Yeah.
And got paid $20 more for the used badass one.
Right, exactly.
Which shows to me that you were building that, because that was a while ago.
Yeah, that's the...
But you have slowly kind of like cobbled together a pretty sweet setup here. So you're going to use your DeVille.
Sure, I've got a sweet amp, so that's a good start. 60
watts with 212s that's been serviced recently enough.
Yeah, you all have been listening to that. Well, yeah. Okay, so just to break it down, let's start with the mics. Like I said, I got one large diaphragm condenser, two small diaphragm condensers, and then one dynamic mic. And then I borrow other people's dynamic mics. Because there's always, like, those are the dynamic mics, you know, finding SM57s and 58s and whatnot, or things like it. Pretty easy, right? I mean, like, most people can, if they have a mic, they're going to have a mic like that.
They'll have a 57 or a 58, probably, so, or a copy of that.
You know, like, so I was recording drums the other day, and I borrowed, you know, like, three or four dynamic mics to kind of round out the holes. You know,
and
so I can.
How was that experience? That was your first time recording a drone,
right? Well, hold on. Let's stay focused here. And then I've got I upgraded recently because I was going to record drums. I never really recorded drums before. Because I was going to record drums, I need to upgrade my audio interface so that I have 8 channels of separately trackable inputs. Right? It's the only way you can do drums is with at least like I've looked online at least. The least you can do drums with is 3 separate tracks. Because you could do, say, like, or you could do like a triangle approach, which is what they call it, where you try to get 3 capsules in an equilateral triangle to kind of avoid phase issues. So you do like 2 overheads and 1 in front of the bass drum or something like that.
Right.
And then you try to get those 3 capsules equidistant apart. That's one way to do it. It's not what I did because I've had 8 inputs.
What's this machine that you got?
So I got the inputs. FP10 Freesonics. Again, this is like second generation stuff. So there's newer audio interfaces out there. In fact, I was looking. I had the Scarlett. That's what I use for you know. I've been using all these years. Which is just 2 inputs. And it's nice. I like the Scarlett. It sounds good. It's got good controls. And they have, but I got the, was it Presonus FP10? Yeah. Which I found in Houston, actually, on Craigslist. And talked the guy down to selling it to me for like $150.
Not bad.
Yeah.
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 So what is this? Does it have any kind of preamping ability or anything like that?
Yeah, it has preamps, but they're clean preamps. They are supposed to be, you know, transparent. So there's no real, hopefully, no signal processing. I mean, of course there is.
Because, to some degree, yeah.
You know, that's just, you know, like, was it a...
It's the nature of gear.
Well, you can't, was it the Heisenberg principle or whatever, that you can't measure something without changing it, right? So, you know,
you
like,
can't observe something without changing
it. Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah. So you know, so everything puts a little bit of a touch of something on there, but
which
that's
is
just
the reason people buy high-end gear.
Well, that's why they buy certain mics and they buy certain, you know, preamps and whatnot, and that's great. If you're out there and you have $20,000, get yourself a badass studio. Good for you. But most people don't. Yeah. So, and I don't. So you know, I'm trying to go bare bones and just, and then push what I have to the limits, you know? That's best you can do. That's what you're going to do if you spend $20,000 anyways. You're going to push that really nice stuff to its limits.
The bulk of your effort should go towards crafting the songs.
Yeah.
Because if the songs are amazing, even if you recorded them on your phone, they would still
totally
be amazing.
Hitting the mics. Speaking of mics, so got that, and then just run everything into Reaper, and I'm really loving Reaper. It's a great program, easy for me to understand. And so when I did drums, and drums are always like the most complicated thing you can do because it's a complicated acoustic instrument, right? Acoustic instruments are always going to be harder to record than electric instruments. And drums are really hard because there's like, they're technically like, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or how many different instruments that are all being played at the same time.
So who's this guy that was playing drums?
I got Jason McKenzie. He's a drummer for Atash here in Austin, and he's also played with Billy Joe Shaver. Mm-hmm. That was his, but he's since moved on. He's not with that band anymore. But that was his money gig.
He's good. He brought.
He's super good. He's also a. He plays kit and he plays tabla. And he was there on that jam when I met Andrew Deep too. He was playing on that. He plays like a hand drum as well. That's sort of like a tambourine, but without the cymbal-y thing stuck in it.
I wonder if you can hear the cello. Andrew's roommate is giving a cello lesson.
Yeah, it sounds like he's just practicing now because he's playing.
Maybe she took off, but yeah, you can hear it. It sounds lovely.
Yeah.
So you had him, and he added the power ballad drums to my Muslim in Paris tune.
Right.
And brought that song to the next level. Mm-hmm. I was...
I'll give you all the secrets. Here's all the secrets to how I recorded the drum. You can do this too. So, like I said, I borrowed like... I had like 1, 2, 3, 4... 4 like dynamic mics... like a 50, 258s, a 57, and then like a Sennheiser that I have that's like a 58. It's supposed to be designed more for like a male voice, so I tend to use it on things that are pitched kind of lowish. Although it works just fine. That's what I recorded the violin on today, straight out of the amp. Mm-hmm. And then Jason had the Shure like SM52, I think it is. It's on there. Yeah, the 52, which is a bass drum dynamic mic. It's a big dynamic mic. And then I have my 2 AKG 2000s. Mm-hmm. Or 1000S. Sorry, 1000S. C1000S. That's what we're recording on right now. And they're small diaphragm condensers. And a AT Audio Technica 4050 or 4040 or something. It's a large diaphragm condenser. So you're going to use the dynamic mics as close mics for the individual drums and cymbals. So I put one on the hi-hat, one on the 57 on the snare, and then the two toms. I put a close mic, dynamic mic, right on the head, pointing down at the head of the drum to get the attack on those drums and cymbals. And then I put the bass drum dynamic in the bass drum hole, so I get the click, you know, clicky, kind of like inside the drum kind of sound. Mm-hmm. I took the other, the large diaphragm, and just put it up against the bass drum as well, but on the head to kind of get the outside of the drum, right? Mm-hmm. So I get my bass, cover my basses.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, good stuff. And then I put the small diaphragm condensers as overheads, and I put them in an XY pattern like we're doing right now. So it's a stereo, not a stereo pair. Normally drum mics is like a stereo pair. They're both like over the drums pointing down. But I decided to go with a XY, which gives you more like a spectrum.
Okay. I like the XY. That's a cool thing that you came across there.
So with those mics, you're getting everything because they're up above the drum. They're basically like a room mic. Right.
They give you a lot of cymbal dynamics too.
Of course. Well, because again, I wasn't close miking the individual cymbals.
It would be annoying to do that.
Yeah. Well, and also what's the point? They're cymbals. You're going to hear them. And they're not the most important part of the drum sound, in my opinion. They're, you know, it's like the bass and the snare are the most important things. And then, so I record, you know, wide open, just get good levels for everything so everything's nice and strong. You know, that's all I can do with my FP10 is just make sure that I'm getting a signal that's kicking out, you know, pretty strong, like around 6 decibels, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's consistent. And, you know, again, really good players are the biggest part, and them knowing what they're going to do is a huge part of the recording process because again, if somebody can be consistently playing their instrument a certain way, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, what's coming out, as long as they're consistently making the same volumes, you know, that makes all the difference in the recording process, you know, because that's really what you're dealing with recording is like volumes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so anyway, I record all that. And then if you go into the effects, the most important thing after that was processing. So I get getting good levels, everything sounding good. And then I go in and on the close mics, you put a limiter or a gate on them. Gate. Mm-hmm. So that you only hear those individual drums when they're being struck. The rest of the time you get no signal, mm-hmm. right? So it hits, it comes in, it goes away. It hits, it comes in, it goes away. That way you're getting the clarity of just that, and you're not getting a bunch of bleed from the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So you do the bass drums, everything but the overheads, you put a limiter on.
All right.
So that, or a gate, sorry. Limiter's top, gate's bottom. Mm-hmm. So we want a gate on them. And then, so that's a big deal because that clarifies everything immediately. That takes a bunch of extra mud out of there and phase problems.
And are you using a filter from Reaper to do the gating?
Yep. Yep. Okay. The gates, it's on there. So that's the first line in the chain.
Okay.
And then, EQ is the next one. And I just use presets for the drums, honestly. And then fooled with them a little bit, but they were really good sounding drums and they sounded pretty good through the mics. The mics didn't really color it too much, in my opinion.
So what you heard when you played it back sounded close enough to the room.
Well, like I said, I just used the presets for the bass and the snare and the toms mm-hmm. that come with Reaper. So they've got EQ presets that kind of cut out stuff that you don't need. And also the other thing I think with EQ is important is think about, like which instruments are gonna live in which parts of the EQ.
Very important. Yeah.
And then just give those over to that instrument and cut everything else out.
It's something in bands that'll give away a band as being kind of amateurish when they're all occupying, or a lot of them are occupying a similar space.
Frequencies. The
frequency space. And so canceling each other out. That's a problem people have when they're, you know, they've been playing with a guitar player might be playing with a fuzz pedal in their room for a year.
Yeah.
Just sounding like God. And then they go play out with their band. As soon as they step on the fuzz pedal, they're gone from the mix. Like they can't hear themselves anymore. So that's why you find players using tones that on their own would be annoying.
Yeah.
Like way too trebly. Or way too much bottom, but when you put them into the musical context, they sound great. A lot of the great guitar lead tones in recording history, if you isolated them, they would be a little shrill or offensive on their own, not working really.
Yeah.
It's in that musical context when everything has its own space. Totally. It sounds so beautiful, and that's also how you ID a band that's really pro.
Yeah.
When they EQ their shit accordingly.
Exactly. So the drums are going to kind of do that in and of themselves. They're like, think of drums as like a band within a band.
Yes.
So we're going to do that. So we're going to, you know, give over the bass drum, obviously gets the low end, and then go from tom to little tom to snare to hi-hat. And that's kind of like your spectrum, you mm-hmm. know, you're going from lowest to highest. And then the cymbals are going to be in there, you know, wherever. So then the overheads, I kind of cut out all the low in the overheads. So, you know, because cymbals aren't going to make a whole lot of frequencies much below 100.
Right.
You know, or 150. So you can just do a general bass cut out on those. And then and also that's the other thing. Remember, your overheads are going to get the kit. Like you could put the overheads into the mix and it would be like a scratch drum kit. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, it would basically have everything.
Yeah, just not as, maybe not as round as you
so
want.
So, when you're mixing, you want to put, you know, I guess my theory was you want to put, they're going to be like your bass level. And then whatever you want to bring out, whether it's snare or bass or toms, you can adjust that with the individual close mics, right? Mm-hmm. And then, so yeah, so did EQing and then compression, just so that, you know, when things come through, they are springing into the mix as opposed to they're there. Mm-hmm. They're there. You know what I mean? So when they come in, they come in. And again, once you have the gate on there, it's nice because you're compressing something that's strong and not bringing out the little, you know, background noise that the close mic's picking up from all the other drums. And I did zero reverb because I just like the dry sound in that mix. And also this particular tune, the lead instruments have a bit of a reverb-y wash going on.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
Hey, girl.
And
Andrew's wife just came in the room.
Steelbacker's sunglasses.
To get her sunglasses.
And anyway, so no reverb. But what I did do is I put flange on the hi-hat just because I wanted to give it that kind of like funny 70s kind of thing.
Yeah, or like some glam metal.
Yeah, and just give it that, you know, everybody's mix should have a little bit of subliminal, like, what is going on?
I think it, like, whenever, you know? I was
that, just, it's like a je ne sais quoi.
That song Rocket Queen by Guns N' Roses, they put like a touch of flange on the vocal at parts mm-hmm. and on the cymbals. And it does. It fucks with the listener in mm-hmm. a fun way.
Mm-hmm.
Takes some like, it's like, oh, well, something, you know what I mean? Like there's a certain nuance to it that puts you in a different headspace or puts you off on guard a little bit.
Yeah. And then let's see. I put a little phase on the snare too, because remember, again, with the overheads, you're gonna get whatever effects you put on the individual drums aren't gonna be that strong in the mix because you've got the overheads getting mm-hmm. everything anyway, getting a clean tone, if you will.
Yeah, so it's like a blend. Drums. It's like a blend knob mm-hmm. on a pedal.
Exactly, and again, I want it just to be subliminal. And you could barely, I mean, if you listen to the drum mix altogether, you can barely hear that those effects are happening.
So he plays drums for Atosh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
I did like listening to his style.
He plays tabla.
I thought you would got like a rocker drummer because the style sounded very like power ballad.
Yeah, well, he also plays with Billy Joe Shaver, country. Right. Maybe a little rocking country. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've never been to a Billy Joe Shaver show. Billy Joe Shaver show. So that was good times. And I was pretty happy with the overall.
Yeah, I redid the... After you got the drums on there, that gave it an anchor. So I re-recorded the main electric guitar. And I'll probably redo the acoustic as well. Because I just put those new clear tone strings on my acoustic mm-hmm. and they have changed my fucking life.
Yeah.
The brightest strings I've ever heard. Like when you play them, like other people in your house will come to you and be like, what is that? That sounds nice. I'm hooked on those strings. I've had them on my electric for a bit, but now they're on the my parlor guitar acoustic and it's the shit. I'll re-record that guitar line. Cause now that there's drums to focus on instead of just like a mundane click.
Yeah.
You know, I can play along with those, and for guitar players, syncing up with a drummer is as good as it gets.
Yeah,
it's almost like you let the cymbals lead you. You know what I mean? You've always got something to guide you.
Yeah, totally. Well, and that was another thing we had to work out was getting a good click for him, because the Reaper, the way I'd set up the track, he didn't like the Reaper click. It was the Reaper click was on the quarter, and he wanted eighth note.
Yeah, yeah.
He wanted a tighter or smaller subdivision mm-hmm. and so he whipped up a quick like click track on actually he uses Ableton for his producing because he does a lot of he actually has a side project where he does like electronic music.
Did he bring his own laptop with Ableton?
Yeah so he just whipped up a quick click track that I just popped into the track, and then he was like, oh, that's what I need. And so so that's cool.
Shit, maybe we should borrow that idea for ourselves.
Well, you know, I mean, we could I could have set up if we'd have done it the normal way and started with drums, you know, a drummer in the room, we would have set up the click differently to begin with, and there wouldn't have been a problem. Although I need to get some samples to upload to Reaper. You can change the sound of the click by just uploading different, you know, waves into it. And so I need to get that cowbell down and make it. Reminds me, so I can make a more like, you know, percussive, like high pitch click. Cause usually that's what people like. They like something that cuts through the mix.
Well, nothing beats a cowbell.
Cowbell
and a hi-hat. Those are great things.
So we got that done. And so that was kind of a Rubicon for me.
Have you laid any more tracks for your solo thing?
Yeah, well, just a little bit. I started on another fiddle tune, and I've got scratch versions that we've been either doing here on the podcast or elsewhere. So I've got stuff going, but the other thing was he led me to another recording gig where he'd been recording this song for a friend of his from New York, and he had done MIDI strings on it, and he was like, can you record real strings over these? And I said, yes, I can. And so that's what I've been doing this week, is recording a 16 voice, 4-part string section on his piece. So what, 16 tracks of strings divided into 4 cellos, 4 violas, 4 violin 2s, and 4 violin 1s.
What are you doing, just the viola and violin?
No, I'm playing it all. I've got this cello here. I played the cello on it too.
Are you any good at the cello?
I'm good enough for this track.
Okay.
And also, we live in the 21st century. There's auto-tune.
Yeah.
So you can get close enough,
uh-huh,
and it'll sound pretty good. So, sorry. Sorry, all you purists out there.
I didn't even know you had auto-tune.
Yeah, the Reaper comes with auto-tune.
That's cool.
And it's decent. It's not...
You don't sound like Cher?
No. Well, and the point is, with this stuff, so I'll tell you all exactly how to do it, too, because you might want to do it, too. I did 4 tracks of each voice, and I auto-tuned the cello just because I'm not a great cellist. I know what I'm doing, but I'm not going to nail it. But mostly what I was just trying to get was a shimmery, chorusy sound by recording four. It's the only reason you'd record 4 different tracks is so that it's kind of like the same things happening, but they're a little out of phase with one another. And that's what makes a good string section sound, you know? The point of, like, it's good for everybody to be in tune, but the slight out-of-tuneness that naturally happens in a symphony string section is what makes a symphony string section sound like that, right? Like, if it was perfectly in tune, you would still get kind of like a macro tone that would be kind of like fatter than the alone, all alone. But the fact that people are like vibrating slightly out of phase with each other and slightly out of pitch with each other creates like a chorus effect or a flanger effect, kind of, that's what you want.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That's what the sound is. So anyway, so I record 4 of each, and then I just went through and I'm not going to make it perfect, obviously. That's not my approach. I'm not trying to make everything exactly perfectly in tune. But close enough that it's not like egregiously out of tune.
As long as it's not annoying. You don't want someone's asshole to pucker.
Well, I want you to focus on the voice in this track, right? Uh-huh. And listen to the words and the beauty of the singing. And the chorus strings is there to be exactly that, like a chorus in the background, just kind of murmuring or singing along and padding it all out. So as long as you don't, your ear doesn't switch from the voice to that, then I've done my job. And that's the way I look at it.
What kind of track is this?
It's a song about... I don't know exactly what's going on, because I don't even know this person that I'm doing it for.
What's the tempo? What style of
it's slow. It's okay. Kind of, it's almost like a hymn, It was a very, like, self-empowering hymn.
Okay.
And that's kind of thing. And then the chord progression is very simple. It's like a 1-6-4-5 chord progression, mm-hmm. with a couple of little variations to make it more dramatic. Also, there's a half-step modulation towards the end, so it goes up and brightens up at the end.
I always like that.
Yeah. So... And the other thing, recording-wise, like I was saying, I don't want it to be perfect, but if anything takes away from the sound of the voice, since I have four tracks of each voice, just take it out. Mm-hmm. Just excise anything that's really annoying. And it doesn't matter, like, you've lost 1/4 of the you know, combined volume of that, but you still have... three other tracks that are playing, so it doesn't matter. You don't notice really that all of a sudden it gets much quieter or something because you cut something out. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did, because, you know, I'm pretty good, but, you know, like, I'm still a human being, so when I record, I mean, except for the cello, but the other 12 tracks, in the end, like, there's only, like, you know, it's maybe like 1-2% of those tracks need to be cut out. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. that's really all it is. If you just listen carefully, you can hear those moments. And so you just go in and cut it. Or, you know, I could go back and re-record for those little tiny seconds. Because it's literally, we're talking about, like, a note, mm-hmm. you know? Or two notes.
Couldn't you just mute that out in the mix?
That's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I did. Instead of, like... in other words, you don't always need to overdub the right thing if you have four of the things and one is out. You just take the one out and you still have three of the things, you know. That's my whole point. So and then, you know, so I cleaned it up by doing that. And, you know, because I was trying not to spend 20 hours doing this job that I'm not going to get paid a ton of money for in the first place.
How long
place.
Did it take you to do it?
I'd say I'm almost at half that. I'd say I'm like, probably took me, I mean, the song was long too. Mm-hmm. It's like a 6 or 7 minute long song. So just tracking everything took me at least 2 hours. And then going back and editing has taken me probably 4.
So 6 hours altogether.
So I'm still, still clocking in at like a, you know, a decent minimum wage.
You're making Texas minimum wage for sure.
Yeah. So, but it's more about the process, so that the next time I do this, give me a call, I'll do this. the next time I do this, I can do it faster. You know, I know exactly what I'm doing. But I'm pretty happy with the results, and I'll let you all know when the track comes out.
What's the name of the artist?
Her name is, like I said, again, I haven't met the actual person. Christina. I don't know her last name.
Christina, sure, you're lovely.
Yeah, I need to email her. In fact, I don't think she even knows who I am, because I've just been working through Jason. Mm-hmm. So this is the wonderful world of the internet, where you work on stuff, you know, over the internet.
And yeah,
you may never meet the person in real life, or ever, you know, even contact them. So, but I'll contact her, because that won't be hard, and she's gonna pay me. So,
cool. So you had a recital with your with your kids. Huh? How did that go?
The recital was pretty awesome. That was November 11th. At the Blacker Bee Violin Shop Hall, which is a nice performance space here in Austin. Good acoustics, amazing piano, mm-hmm. well tuned. And I had about a dozen or so of my kids perform their solo pieces. And I accompanied a lot of them, because I can do basic piano to play along with.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty good at that. I'm not always perfect.
Didn't you have a pianist?
Yeah, and then for the stuff that I am not capable of doing, they hired my friend Nikki Birdsong. to play piano, and she's an amazing professional pianist here in town, and very good at the accompaniment stuff, very sensitive to the kids, and can really follow them really well. Mm-hmm. And
one of the kids' dads came and played guitar, right?
Sure. Actually, yes. So one of my students did the Man of Constant Sorrow bluegrass song or folk song, which you may recognize from the Coen Brother movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, you definitely recognize it from that movie.
And she basically did it in that style and same key and everything, which is really Alison Krauss and Union Station doing it. Or really, what's his name? I forget what the singer's name is, guitar singer.
The one that recorded it on the soundtrack?
Yeah, what's his name?
I don't remember his name, but he's awesome.
And anyway, so she sang and played violin or fiddle, and I wrote a fiddle break for it. But then her dad is a former professional guitarist. He was in like metal bands in the 80s and stuff.
Was he German?
German.
I love that he was an 80s metal German guy.
Yeah, he's cool.
I think we should have him on the podcast. I want to pick his brain.
I'd love to. Well, he's got a great guitar collection and two killer amps. His Marshall half stack from those days.
What has he got, like a JCM or something?
He's got a nice. And then he's got a nice little combo. Boutique combo amp.
Yeah, those metal guys.
Bunch of cool guitars. He's got a resonator guitar. He's got a PRS. I think he's got a Les Paul. He's got his old, his metal guitar from those days.
Like a BC Rich or Ibanez?
It's like a, what is he?
ESP?
I think he's got a Strad, actually, Stratocaster.
Like a Super Strat with the Floyd Rose?
Maybe? Yeah, but it's all beat up. Like, he personalized it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but he's got a sweet PRS. That's really nice. And anyway, so he played acoustic, and then I played mando. I played mando for a couple of the tracks, a couple of the performances.
Yeah, I watched the video for that. So we're actually at the end of this podcast, we're gonna put a recording from that recital.
Yeah.
Of Andrew playing one of his solo pieces.
Yeah, a new piece that I wrote for viola.
Which is sort of a thing, if you've ever been to recitals, a lot of times the teacher at the end of it, or even at dance recitals, a lot of times at the end, the teacher or teachers will then do like, okay, well, here, enjoy a nice grown-up artist execution here. I'll play a number that'll be above the student level to just round out the concert experience a little bit.
Well, I mean, I only teach so that moments like that can happen where I'll have everybody stuck in a room and they'll want to listen to me.
Yeah, yeah. That's the whole reason to teach is the recital crowd.
That's right.
The cookies and the hanging.
Yeah, the cookies. The cookies afterwards are the best.
Did you guys serve refreshments?
Oh, of course. Well, I mean, yeah, that was kind of like, I asked everybody to bring.
I would be super disappointed if you didn't have refreshments.
And a lot of them came home. In fact, I think you might have ate some of them.
I might have sampled some of the treats. I do like that your students bring you baked things sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I come over, there's just like, oh, there's cupcakes? That's weird. And then it's a student that brought it. Some cute little kid gave it to Andrew, made by his mom or something.
Yeah.
I love that kind of shit. So what else has been going on? I've been reading Duff McKagan's book.
Yeah, tell us
book,
what have you been studying?
It's So Easy in Other Lives. So I've been playing, as far as my guitar playing, I've been doing a lot of drones. Just looping a drone into the Ditto looper and then using my new little drum machine and then just trying to stay interesting within the context of a single chord. So I've been playing that a lot and then working with some YouTube lessons. Though I still have my own, I want to break into ragtime and sort of rockabilly jazz a little bit.
Yeah.
But that stuff is hard.
Weird. Rockabilly jazz?
Sort of where, if you ever listen to like Danny Gatton.
It's oxymoronic there.
No, it's not. It's there's players like Danny Gatton, Roy Buchanan.
Okay, yeah.
Who sort of broke the wall between jazz and ragtime and sort of like country, speed country, like rockabilly and stuff. And there's one other player out of New York. I forget his name. He's got a hard to say last name.
Hillbilly Jazz.
Don.
Let's call it that.
Don Camparillo or something. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's that amazing Telecaster jazz.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I would like to get in. I'll probably need to pay somebody to help me learn shit like double stops and
how
those phrases and stuff. But the drone thing is easy to just work on your own, and I borrow stuff from YouTube, different drone guitar lessons on there. But I've been reading about Duff McKagan's book. I think this is his second book, but it's it talks a lot about his childhood in Seattle and the early punk scene.
Yeah.
So like several of the members of Guns N' Roses were deeply involved in the punk scene. In fact, Duff's band 10 Minute Warning was signed by Jello Biafra's label,
okay,
I think, which was Alternative Tentacles, I think was the name of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, just hearing about these bands and the way they would put themselves to the test, like when he got to LA to see if the people in your band could hack it, you would plan these tours where they had no money. You would just get in a van and live by your wits and play shows and crash at people's houses, and then be a good way to find out if anyone in your band didn't have the balls to make it, because they would drop out.
Right.
And just hearing how he sort of brought this punk aesthetic to LA and tried to put together this
baptism by fire.
Yeah, this band with like a punk crust that leaned on, you know, AC/DC and Cheap Trick and Aerosmith. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating world. He sort of escaped from Seattle when it was caving in on itself from heroin. Well before, you know, Nirvana and that problem with heroin, there was the movement in Seattle was heavily affected by it. You had a ton of killer bands. The guy from Mother Love Bone was one of their casualties. And so this young, you know, whatever, 19-year-old Duff McKagan is leaving the scene, even though he's a big part of that scene.
Yeah.
He sort of had to leave it to escape from this drug craze.
And but he continued to have serious substance abuse issues,
but
right?
Never really heroin.
Okay.
He has serious alcoholism and cocaine problems.
Yeah.
But I think seeing so many people destroyed by heroin helped him sort of step over that one. Now, Izzy and Slash and Steven Adler all had a terrible time with heroin.
Right.
Though I think Izzy got clean in like 89. He was one of the first ones to go totally clean.
Yeah.
And Axl, too. He kicked heroin very early. But yeah, the heroin thing plagued a couple of them well into the
stadium. I think I might have heard an interview with Duff. Is it true that he like... It was like a martial arts instructor that told him to go get clean and told him how to do it and kind of
this martial arts instructor who did a lot of mental stuff too. You could see, there's a documentary about Duff that you could watch that goes into that a little bit. It is interesting. He basically, his pancreas, I think, exploded.
Yeah, he almost died.
And so he's got these like third degree burns inside his body.
Jesus.
And morphine, like they were dumping morphine into him and it did nothing.
He's still in pain?
Yeah, basically it was too strong of a pain for... You can reach a pain point where painkillers won't do it.
Sure.
And he had reached that point. And so he has to give up alcohol. He detoxes in a hospital bed and they had to do some emergency surgery. And so he gets out of it and he turned to physical exertion to get rid of things like the DTs.
Yeah.
He was doing mountain biking. But he linked up with some badass martial arts instructor. And he said some days the guy would just stretch him out and talk, like give him psychological training.
Yeah.
Sort of talk him through being strong, kind of being a man and taking control of your surroundings.
Yeah.
And then other days he would put him through these brutal workouts.
Well, that was the thing was, I think he said, you know, go home and clean your house and don't come back until you've cleaned. Oh, get up every morning, make your own food.
Yeah.
And don't come back to me until you can do those things.
Yeah, basic things.
You know? Which is like hilarious because, you know, it's like you think of like the rock and roll lifestyle and how antithetical that is to it.
Yeah, there are a rocker who lives on the road, usually their place looks like a hotel room. It's like pizza boxes, you know, maybe a futon mattress in the middle of it. But yeah, those are important things. Your home is your temple, so it has a psychological impact on you if you live in a gross-ass bedroom or a gross apartment or whatever.
Or you're living with toxic people.
Yeah, toxic people. Yeah, definitely. But it's a fascinating book. And, you know, it goes well into the guy's life. But if you're a big fan of punk music, which a lot of people in America are,
yeah,
a lot of players sort of wean themselves on punk. It was the movement that showed people, hey, anybody can do this. You know, you don't need to be Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. You just need to be able to do what you're trying to do.
You won't sound like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Yeah, you won't, and that's fine. You know? but yeah, I had read Slash's book, and you know, it's just interesting. I'm trying to piece together a little bit of American history through rock and roll, or Western history. And rock and roll at this point is becoming one of the great pillars of history in America. Such a new country. There's not a lot to lean on as far as history. We've got the American Junkie. And, you know, the seductive prose of the American Junkie.
Yep.
And we got rock and roll.
Yeah. That's our. Well, we got other things too. We got bluegrass. We got jazz.
We do.
We got, you know, of course the cream of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
For sure. And all the dregs of the Industrial Revolution.
Model T Ford.
So
we got some shit for sure. But to me, rock and roll is one of the most important things. Yeah. Yeah, like there were the blues and the jazz and the things that sort of stewed together produce our great period of rock and roll.
Yeah. Which well, is like the 50s. It is the, you know, the 20th century was in America. The other thing is that rock and roll and the hedonistic lifestyles and the return to an ecstatic existence, mm-hmm. as opposed to a, you know, puritanical or aesthetic,
just scraping existence. By like a depression era existence.
Well, sure, exactly. You know, mm-hmm. like, you know, the idea that it's okay to have all the things you love and mm-hmm. and experience all the things you love.
Well, or if teenagers have money and they're going to spend it on things like, let's make records for them. I think a lot of that is the vibe of rock and roll is like, let's make something, let's, you know, some nonsensical lyrics, a badass beat.
This whole idea of like having a teenage existence, because, you know, up until the 20th century or the Industrial Revolution, there was no, you were a kid and then you were working.
And then you were in the fields.
And you were probably, and when you made that switch, could be as early as like 8, you know. It could be as early as fucking, I don't know, 6, you know.
Depending on
where you are,
how good of a build you had, I would guess. Like if a kid was tall, especially a male, I'm sure they were out working pretty quickly. It's you know, definitely.
And now we have, you know, 11 to 18 year olds who have whole lot of free time.
They have a fucking
do.
Supercomputer in their hand.
Yeah,
24/7.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of great music in the tween market these days. I think maybe like The Weeknd is some of the better stuff, but there's a lot of shitty shit on the radio.
Yeah,
as always, you know.
Well, you live with the tweens, so you.
I do. My roommate has a 12-year-old, so I get to hear a lot of Drake. And which, you know, I have a Drake album. I have 3 Kanye albums. It's not like I hate this shit. It's just, I feel like they're not really focusing on the best stuff that those artists have put out.
Yeah.
They're usually focusing on the latest hits, a lot of divas. But I like to stay abreast of whatever.
Is she into Taylor Swift?
A little bit. Mercifully, not a lot of Taylor Swift in that.
Uh-huh. What's the other big one? Miley just never quite hung out there long enough to.
Miley's definitely got a fan base. She did that record with the Flaming Lips.
Yeah,
I didn't care for it, but you look online and she's packing large venues, so somebody's listening to that chick. And I like how she's hypersexual in a very feminist way.
Yeah,
so I feel like, you know, she might be a good role model for a certain type of kid. Musically, I'm not connecting with her. I really like when she goes country. She's got a stellar Dolly Parton style voice.
Yeah. Well, that's what she actually trained for her entire life.
That's her. She's a Nashville kid.
Yeah.
If you set her down at a party with an acoustic guitar and a fiddle player, she could entertain you for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, she's a pretty damn good rhythm guitar player.
She's an example, I think, of like somebody who is rebelling against something that's actually, you know, like she you know, she's totally rebelling as an artist, mm-hmm. And she'll probably like get over it at some point and go back to like her roots and make like an incredible country album one day.
She's still terribly young. I bet you Miley in her 30s will be making some pretty stellar country, and it might even have some commercial success, you know. Who knows? This is a great time for country music.
Exactly, the next 4 years.
What's her name, is it Margaret?
Everybody's
Price?
Gonna be playing to the country group because you know, look at what just happened.
I think
politically.
It's gonna come. There's the Sturgill Simpson is amazing. You're starting to see, I think even at Coachella there was even a country artist booked. There's been several that have made it on Saturday Night Live in the last season or two. So you never know. We might have another wave.
Oh, I think that's definitely coming. I mean, the whole conservative backlash that exemplifies our last political cycle is going to take us to the country music zone. It's not going to take us to the, you know, like far out, you know, like alternative music zone.
Well, what are you saying? There's already that commercial country, like the Florida Georgia.
Well, that stuff's
line.
Never gone away, but it'll just become more of a prevalent theme. Well, the other thing, like just to say, you know, to bring it home, that was one of the reasons that Jason left playing with Billy Joe Shaver, was that he knows that like he was just kind of sick of always playing for like Trump supporters.
Yeah, is there a lot of that? Usually the alt country in Austin.
Well, it's not alt country. Billy Joe Shaver's not alt country. He's country.
But he plays the Continental, right? He's
Yeah, but I mean, he's straight up, like, his, if you listen to his sound, it's very straight up. Like, he's Texas country, but he writes.
But usually in Austin, the country and rockabilly guys play to a fairly liberal crowd of usually older Austin.
That's true, and that's more true of, like, some of the Texas artists, like the Flatlanders, like, you know, Joe Ely and those sorts of people. They're doing more of that stuff. Of course, Willie. Of course. You know, who's the other guys like that, but you know, those sorts of guys. But then there's also people who just are, you know, they're working through Nashville, they're just living in Austin, in Texas. In other words, not every Texas country artist is necessarily like alt country, you know. They're we even have people like the Maines, you know, Lloyd Maines and what's the Dixie Chick, anyway,
one of the Dixie Chicks.
The Dixie Chick and her dad are from Texas, and but they're straight up.
I thought all the Dixie Chicks were from Texas.
Maybe they are. I don't know.
I thought so.
Hey, Dixie Chicks.
Yeah,
you guys can make another comeback. Fighting the man again.
Did Tatiana ever tell you when they played well after their prime, like in the early aught years, the Dixie Chicks were huge. They were playing.
Oh, sure.
Frank Irwin Center and stuff. But when they played Austin City Limits many years later, in like the later aught years, Tatiana, our friend's wife, was telling me when she was working for PBS doing camera work for Austin City Limits, and she said like no one was allowed backstage. They had heavy security.
Oh yeah, well that's because they spoke out against Bush, right?
And then so yeah, Tatiana was telling me like at the time the employees were like kind of annoyed by it, but she said she read an article later where they had all these death threats.
Oh my god, yeah.
From like Toby Keith fans.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, like, again, you know, back to the political thing. It's like they spoke out against the war and they paid for it career wise, and obviously their peace
with their
and
nervous
security
systems too. Yeah. They paid for it.
Because it's again, it's not like George Bush actually went after the Dixie Chicks. He's a gentleman. You know, he's not actually,
but
you know,
Fox News went after.
No. Well, Fox News, and then of course the lunatics out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, lunatics. How you doing?
Why
are you listening to this? Shouldn't you be listening to something that's way more white supremacy?
or at least Alex Jones.
Yeah. You know, those are the people that they're worried about, because you know it's like that's the other thing, is we enter this new age. It's not the actual government so much that you have to worry about. You have to worry about the laws that they passed and how they're going to affect and blah blah blah. But so far in this country, you know, most of the time you can speak your mind and you don't have to worry. You know, like we don't understand. Like I was listening to Eugene Merman the other day, and Eugene Merman was born in Russia, and then came to America. And this is like communist Russia. And so, you know, he didn't really remember being in communist Russia because they moved pretty quickly. But he heard his parents talking about it and his grandparents talking about it. And the ways that the government actually, you know, would come after you if you spoke out. They would, like he said, you know, it's not such a big deal when, you know, Trump's tweeting back at you. That's normal. That's speech meeting speech meeting speech, and that's how this country goes.
Yeah.
But it's when they threaten to audit your grandparents.
That's exactly it.
And you guarantee, and you know damn well that it's gonna come up as with a conviction against your grandparents, and your grandparents are going to go to jail.
When the only good jobs are state jobs, that's all they have to say. It's like, we see your uncle works for the state.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want him to not have a job.
You wouldn't want your cousins to not have food because
we
fired your uncle.
So you know, it's when they do. And in America, you know, of course, we don't have state jobs. So, you know, we don't have to worry about that.
Not
you
nearly
know.
As much.
But you might worry about your corporation finding out how you spoke and being angry at you, or you might want to but you know, again, if the IRS starts auditing people for no reason, you know, it's because there's got to be a mechanism, there's always got to be a legal, I'm using my air quotation marks, a legal mechanism for how the power is abused. Right, that's how it works in the modern world. It's not gonna, I mean, there's of course people like the Dixie Chicks have to worry about X factors, people, human beings that are crazy coming after them. But as far as the actual government cracking down on you, it's going to come through like a formal process. You know, it might be a kangaroo court, but it'll be a formal process. And that's the point Eugene Merman was making, is that like, you know, we don't really understand what government oppression is really like in this country. Most people don't, because we haven't ever really experienced it in the same ways that we have. Now, I'm speaking from my own white man perspective. You know, obviously there's a difference out there, but you know, that's what I'm just saying. So anyway, musicians, keep making your art. Use that anger to make pretty music, who cares?
Use your anger to make pretty music.
Yeah,
right. Is that
I don't know, whatever.
That's what you were driving at?
That's what I was saying. Well, it's the Neil Gaiman quote, your country just elected a racist misogynist billionaire, make great art. There you go. That's your response.
That's what I've been looking
that should be
to.
You know, that's a good response.
I'm remembering fondly of all the amazing shit that got made during the last Republican administrations, Reagan and Bush Jr. How could you not look forward to that? The comedy is going to be great. The rap music is going to be great and deep and relevant again. You know, it's like it's going to be good times. You know, it's not what
the
you
comedy
wanted.
Has already been off the
it
chain.
It is. It's not exactly what
the
you
last
wanted.
Two SNLs have just been sick.
They've been great. I love them. Alec Baldwin is the fucking Donald Trump. I hope that never goes away.
Yes.
All right. Well, we should wrap this one up. We haven't done with just the two an episode with just the two of us in a while. So we wanted to do that and catch everyone up on our projects that we've been doing. We'll have Skylar and Ryan and their band on an episode whenever they release their record, and we'll play some
Totes.
Of those tunes live. And we're going to end it with a piece that Andrew's new piece. The live recital recording of that.
It's a piece for viola with...
Did you have accompaniment on it?
No,
it's
just solo viola.
Okay.
And I used the DADA tuning.
Okay.
And I...
Okay.
And it's influenced by a part from a rag that I heard Indradeep playing. And actually, I played it for him on Friday when I went over for the lesson. And it's, you know, kind of... A little bit of the rag, the rag's at the beginning, and then the part that is more, has a quicker tempo, is actually the part that I heard him playing. And then I kind of spin it out in my own way and turn it from, you know, it's not so much necessarily an Indian piece as it is at some point a Andrew Appalachian fiddle piece slash Andrew classical violinist piece.
All right. Sounds intriguing. Do you have a title for it yet?
I do not. I might... yeah, I don't really have a title. I'll just call it, you know, Movement for Solo Viola.
There you go.
For now.
So we're going to close out on that. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
If anyone out there wants to start a drone band, contact me via the website. All right. Bye.
Bye. Take care.